Hello, everybody. I'm John Atack, and this is Mike Rinder. Hi, Mike.
Hi, John. So nice to see you again after so long.
It's
It's
been
been
something
a
like
bit
a
of a
year,
delay.
yeah. Yeah, you've been avoiding me all this time.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
I'm studiously avoiding you.
Yeah. Just because you had cancer, it's no excuse, Mike, you know. Well, we find ourselves in the middle of a conflagration where fundamentally, since irreconcilable differences separated Aaron Smith Levin from the Aftermath Foundation, a war has brewed. And there are people, devoted people on both sides. It is my hope, after 40 years of dealing with the mess that Scientology creates, it is my hope to not take sides, and to try and, further what is good for all concerned.
Right.
What we have here is a three-cornered fight, and I've been given a lot of questions by Miriam Francis, and we both have publicly expressed our sympathy for her situation, which is dreadful, and we hope that her father will be brought to justice for the awful things that he did. But it's she said, that even though Scientology is an aspect of this, and people will keep saying, remember that there's Scientology there, that there should be justice for anybody who's been involved in anything that has harmed children. I agree with that point of view. I believe you agree with that point of view too.
Absolutely.
And she's pointing the finger very much at you. I would like to say that by my estimation, there are between 3,000 and 4,000 people who are being held as slaves today in the Scientology organization under the name of the C organization. They are
Right.
slaves. They you
They are.
understand that better than anybody understands it because of the time that you spent being a slave of Ron Hubbard and later of David Miscavige. We must not forget that. And bearing in mind Benjamin Franklin's, to paraphrase what he said, we either hang together or we hang separately. And there is, a huge organization with billions of dollars that would like to see an end to us all so that it can triumphantly clear the planet of all common sense and goodness.
Right.
So, with that in mind, I would like to ask some direct and simple questions, which I made a little note of,
Right.
which I have here somewhere. There it is. It's that little one there. Now, you're on the board of Child USA. Yeah.
Yes.
How long have you been on the board there, about?
3 years or maybe four now.
Okay. And what's the objective of Child USA?
To help the victims of particularly child sexual abuse, but any child abuse, and then also extending over into sexual abuse beyond just children. But originally, the mandate of Child USA was to assist victims of child sexual abuse to get justice. And the primary thing that we have focused on is changing the statute of limitations laws state by state in the United States, because the biggest barrier to child sexual abuse and the victims of child sexual abuse getting justice is the fact that many, many times it takes many, many years before A, some of the victims even realize that they were victims, and B, before they are able to even speak about it, and C, let alone go to any authorities and file complaints. And by the time that span has run, the statute of limitations has expired, and there is nothing that anybody can do about it. And in now I believe it's 20, that may be an inaccurate number, but it's a significant number of states, we have managed to get the law changed. And that has been done through lobbying efforts, through writing expertises, through engaging with political figures, whatever it takes, that is what has been done. And it has been exceedingly successful. We are now moving to change these sort of laws around the world so that it's no longer just the United States, but it's all over the world. And it is one of the things that I frankly am most proud about that I have been engaged in my life. It actually started from the Aftermath show.
Yeah.
Because I was looking for an expert to come on the program to talk about the issue of the separation of church and state, and particularly the First Amendment and the law in the United States. And I got referred to a professor at Penn University, Marcy Hamilton, who has written several books on the subject. And I reached out to her and had many discussions with her, and she eventually came and agreed to appear on the Aftermath, and we talked about the First Amendment. And in doing so, she started talking to Leah and me about Child USA, which is something I'd never heard of. And then she said that because of the work that we had done, she wanted to present us with an award at the annual gala for having exposed the child sexual abuse and abuse in general ongoing in Scientology. We went and went to the gala and accepted the award. And then Marcy asked if we would like to be on the board. Leah had too many other commitments. I said, of course. And Bob's your uncle.
Yeah. So, and I think that it's so important. I was, you know, when I first heard that there was a restriction on how much time you had to make a claim against somebody who had done this, it's sort of, there are some things that should not have any statute of limitations, and any harm that is done to children, you should not be protected. You shouldn't be able to go 5 years or 10 years or any period of time and say, well, I'm no longer guilty.
Right.
Despicable. So
yeah, absolutely.
I believe our 13th, and I hope it's going to be lucky. I think it's our 13th conversation on record. And so I think I know you reasonably well. And I think I'd be right in saying that you're a relatively intelligent human being. You don't have to answer that. So the idea that if you were yourself guilty of an offence or a cover-up of an offence, by fighting to get the statutes of limitations lifted, you would be putting yourself in the firing line if you were guilty. That's correct?
Yes, that's correct, obviously.
It would be deeply irrational.
Yes.
And, I mean, but you were in Scientology, so...
I have done irrational things in my life, John. I continue to do irrational things, but that one would take some real... like I'd have to be hit over the head a few times with a hammer before that would be something that I wouldn't recognize was not probably the brightest move.
Yeah. And in this specific case of Miriam Francis, Miriam has said that she filed charges in 2012 in Australia against her abusive father. And in 2017, she was flown by A&E from Australia to Los Angeles to do an Aftermath show in the second season, I think. And you and Leah sat down with her and said, we think you should report this to the LAPD, and helped her, took her to the police. So you'd be doubly stupid if you were actually getting somebody who you had, you know, had some involvement in harming to report this thing and then going and campaigning. So this is a serious contradiction if such a thing has happened. Miriam has said, and this has all happened very rapidly. It's only, I think, on Saturday that I saw this, and I asked Miriam to send me a statement that she read out on escaping down the rabbit hole. And she feels that you know, from that statement, she was bullied into making a statement and going into details of her abuse. And we have to have sympathy for that.
By the show?
Yeah,
the show bullied her into making statements?
The producer insisted on having more details than she was willing to offer at the time.
Okay.
And it's for her to judge how she feels about that.
Of course.
But we have to say that she'd been flown from Australia. She knew she was there to talk about it. Having dealt with victims of abuse myself a fair few times over the last 40 years, there is this difficult situation that once somebody has said, okay, I'm going to go on TV, then they have exposed themselves to, you know, put themselves in a serious situation. That moves us over to Miriam is making assertions herself about what happened. The other case that she's mentioning, and as she says, she spent 12 years so far researching this. There are only two cases that have come up so far. So I would say that if there are any other cases, please get hold of Miriam. Please tell her about your situation. If, you know, you have a situation with regard to Scientology, and perhaps something can come together under her direction and with her help to show, you know, who did what and when, because we would like to see that. We'd like to see anybody who is culpable, anybody who is guilty, brought to justice. But the only other case in which she has brought up your name is that of Carmen Rayner. Mm-hmm. Carmen went on TV with Steve Kinnane, the excellent journalist, Steve, and excellent human being, frankly, Steve Kinnane.
Yes.
Who wrote the book Fair Game, which is a brilliant analysis of the bizarre history of Scientology in Australia. I helped Steve with that book. And at that time, I was very much in the shadows. I did not want to be attacked again by Scientology. So I was talking to authors and I was talking to anybody who had a case involving children. But from 1996 to 2013, those were the only things I did. And I never charged money to help people who'd been harmed by the group. And right. That's been largely the case. You know, I've talked with about 600 people in their recovery, and three of those people made any financial contribution to me. I think the most was £100, you know, which is like $120 or something. So, but through that period, I was still talking with people, and Steve came over from Australia and interviewed me, and he said, will you please talk to Carmen Rayner? I said, I really don't do that kind of thing anymore. It's exhausting. And he told me about this woman who was abused from the age of 6 or 7 till she was 11 by her stepfather, who was a Scientologist. Her mother was a Scientologist too. And at the age of 11, one of her friend's mothers realized what was happening and urged her to go to the police. And she went to the police and made a report. That report was withdrawn on the insistence of Jan Eastgate, who was the head of a group called the Citizens Commission on Human Rights. There is a dreadful irony in the title of that organization. Oh. Representing human rights and persuading a girl to withdraw an accurate report. Carmen's stepfather has since confessed and been convicted for this offense. So there is, or this long series of offenses. So there is no doubt. What has been suggested by Miriam Francis is that you were involved in some way in, you briefed Jan Eastgate, or you wrote the manual that Jan Eastgate worked from to convince Carmen to retract her statement. Let's also say that the Australian Royal Commission took evidence from Carmen, found that evidence substantial. Scientology has paid absolutely nothing in compensation nor made any admission of its guilt in covering this up. Jan Eastgate walked away from prosecution because the law under which she was being prosecuted did not exist in 1985. That's the only reason. Right. We have done a trawl of the documents. I have talked with Carmen Rayner. There is no document, and we're still, you know, there's still somebody looking through documents, but as yet, your name is not mentioned in any of the documents in the Carmen Reyna case. So my understanding is, and again, Miriam Francis has said, you told me that in 1985, at this time, you were an L. Ron Hubbard personal public relations officer. You did not run the case involving
Office of Special Affairs.
Yeah, the Office of Special Affairs or any of the things. She has come back and said, well, in your book, you say that you were an L. Ron Hubbard personal public relations officer in 1990, as if that somehow contradicts the possibility of you having had the job at another time. So let's just put the question directly. Did you have any involvement in the Carmen Reyna case?
No, absolutely none. I knew nothing about that case. And, you know, this is a part of the problem that arises and why I made a comment at one point about, you know, it's virtually impossible to prove a negative.
Yeah.
Because people will say, well, you were the head of the Office of Special Affairs, so you obviously must have known what was going on. And those people actually don't understand how things work in the C organization, but more particularly even in the Office of Special Affairs, and more particularly in the world of David Miscavige. I knew nothing about Carmen Reyna, and as I knew nothing about the activities that are now the source of the potential prosecution of Miriam's father. They just were not things that ever came across my plate. And people say, well, that's not possible. You know, there's all these reports that get written in the Office of Special Affairs. And, you know, Scientology is an immense, an immense conglomeration of people and organizations all over the world. And there are a lot of people and a lot of situations and problems that arise with Scientology every single day. I mean, they've got problems everywhere, all the time. And to think that one person could know about and be involved in directing all of these activities everywhere in the world is pretty far-fetched.
Yeah.
It just didn't happen like that. And, you know, I've had people, even journalists, like the wonderful Peter Reichelt, who has written some amazing stories in Germany about Gottfried Helnwein and other things. And he reaches out to me routinely and says, Mike, can you tell me about this? Can you tell me about that? And I'm like, Peter, I'm sorry. I just didn't know anything about that. Well, how could you not have known about Gottfried Helnwein and this politician in Austria that he was trying to he had a meeting with him and this and that. I'm like, I'm sorry. That just, when that was going on, I was in Clearwater on the Lisa McPherson case, and, you know, Kurt Weiland was dealing with those matters. That wasn't my thing. And I wasn't even allowed to have any briefings from anybody outside that would, quote, distract me from dealing with the Lisa McPherson case. And when I was the LRH Purse PRO, the one thing that I always did throughout my various different positions in Scientology was when there was major international media, I would be called upon to go and deal with it. When the Today Show, when, you know, 60 Minutes, when whatever, like big stuff, the New York Times, I would be called to do it. But I was, for that reason, sort of always identified with the external affairs of Scientology.
Yeah.
Because I was very publicly the face and spokesperson after David Miscavige decided that Heber Jentsch was no longer going to be the talking head for Scientology. Mm. So even though I may have been the commanding officer of CMO International or the LRH Purse Bureau International or a book editor or in the whole, I was always still pulled away from whatever it was that I was doing to go do media. And it makes it appear to everybody or anybody, or can be turned into the appearance that I was always involved in all the things that were going on in Scientology with respect to external affairs. That just isn't the case. And, you know, it when you were talking about Miriam, the one thing that I had done with respect to Miriam that I felt so terrible about was I was the person that brought Miriam's mother to the United States. I brought her because she was a very well-known and lauded portrait artist. She's a fine artist, a painter. And I was charged with the job of updating the What is Scientology book as the LRH Purse Bureau Inn. And I don't know if you remember, John, in the original What is Scientology book, the paintings of the life of L. Ron Hubbard are laughably, wonderful, laughably amateurish at best. And I was looking for a Scientologist who had the skills to be able to do decent paintings. And that was why Kerry was brought to the Int base. Okay. And I had no idea at the time that she was being brought there that anything was going on with her father or Kerry's husband. And in fact, Kerry says she didn't even know about it until whenever it is, the infamous affidavit that I supposedly withheld from Miriam. And I felt like really, really bad about that. And when Miriam came to Los Angeles, I apologized profusely to her. And when she started talking to us about what had happened, it was Leah and I that stopped the production. We okay. shut down production and we said to Miriam and the other woman who I won't even name, but the other woman that was on that program, because the two of them were there together talking about their childhood sexual assault experiences. We said, you need to report this. This can't go unreported. And we contacted the LAPD. And we arranged for the detectives to come to the set. And we shut down the set. And
at an enormous cost, let's, you know, a production set with all of the people working on it, that's tens of thousands of dollars being pushed aside.
We, Leah and I, briefed the detectives and then allowed them to do their interviews. We briefed them sort of on the history of Scientology and why we were the ones that were calling them. And that detective that we originally spoke to on that day is still the detective working this case to this day. I spoke to him last week and he said, do you know that day is seared in my memory for two reasons? One, it is the first time we have ever been called to a set to interview people who were being interviewed. Mm-hmm. But he said, more importantly, it struck me and it has remained with me since that day that those two women did not understand that they were truly victims.
Yeah.
And that it had it not been for you and Leah, this case would never have even started because they did not understand what really had happened to them and that they were victims. And it is heartbreaking to me at this point to be accused of having tried to prevent this prosecution in some way. I understand it. I understand the trauma and, you know, the damage that this sort of abuse inflicts on people, and I do not wish it on anyone. No. And I understand that it can mess people up pretty badly. And I know I don't want to be accused of saying that I believe that Miriam is messed up. You know, it's so difficult to talk about this even or say anything about it. But, you know, I told the detective that spoke to me last week and the other detective in Australia, I said, even after all this had blown up with the down the rabbit hole and whatever, I said, if there is anything that I can do to help, please reach out. If there is anything, if you are trying to find other documents, please let me know. I am happy to help. I will help until the end of time if that is what's necessary, because I believe that this man should be prosecuted and must be prosecuted, and that it is for the good not only of Miriam, but every other potential victim that may be out there. I don't know. I'm rambling now, John, so I'm going to shut up.
No, it's absolutely pertinent. Everything you said is pertinent. And there is a lot in there to sort of walk back to the start of the statement of why didn't you know? Well, there are hundreds of Scientology organizations. And there is this, you know, after the fall of the Guardian's office and the harassment division, branch one, covert data collection, what a lovely title that is, that when that all exploded and 11 Scientologists in the US, including Mary Sue Hubbard, were sent to prison for bugging, burglary, breaking and entering, kidnapping, false imprisonment, all of those things, that a new policy came along. Two things happened. One was the corporate sort out, so that under Larry, later Denise Brennan, to change the corporate structure so that the individual organizations would be like watertight compartments in a ship, that if one of them went down, the Roman Catholic Church, in fact, is organized in a very similar way. The dioceses are all registered separately. Many of them have gone bankrupt because of having to pay compensation for child abuse, quite rightly, as they should. So you've got this thing of this incredible complexity with hundreds. I mean, back in the 90s, I think I counted 400 distinct corporations. Then you have the idea that this stupid Hubbard mistake of telling the world that there was a covert data collection agency. From then on, harassment was outsourced to private detectives, people like Eugene Ingram, a disgraced LAPD officer, who went around the world harassing people. And so you get a lawyer to hire a PI who might hire another PI firm. So that if you get caught, like the guy who hacked Tony Ortega's emails, who was convicted in... And yours, it convicted in June 2015, I think.
Yeah.
So there is an active organization there, but there is also things, you know, you don't, the terrible mistake when the FBI came in July 77, the biggest raid in their history, they found red box documents. They found documents that implicated, you know, the material I have on Charles Manson comes out of one of those boxes, showing his deep involvement with Scientology, which they really didn't want people to know. And there's also the operation where they sought to persuade the world that he'd been involved in the process Church of the Final Judgment under the de Grimstons, a splinter group from Scientology. He may well have had contact with that group. Nobody that, you know, I've spent a year researching this, I've not seen any direct statement that he did. But I have got the operation Scientology put out to say, let's blame it on them so that we don't get blamed. You also have this, the Simon Bolivar policy, the responsibilities of leaders, where Hubbard says, you know, you don't have to tell people what you're doing. You know, you can protect me by going and doing horrible crimes without me ever being blamed because I didn't whisper in your ear and tell you to do this. So you've got what is virtually a mafia culture where people are not any longer reporting these things because those reports may be discovered. So, as you say, in your situation would be that you might have several post titles at the same time and be dealing with thousands of instances. Now, when it comes to Miriam Francis, I think the significant events were in the late 1990s, at a time when you said that the only thing you were working on was Lisa McPherson, because the Lisa McPherson case could have brought Scientology down and should have brought it down.
Absolutely correct.
Yeah.
Absolutely correct.
Lisa McPherson died in the custody of Scientology in Clearwater under the instruction of David Miscavige. She had ligature marks on her ankles and her wrists, and she had died of dehydration and, basically locked up in a Scientology faculty. She'd had a manic episode. She was bipolar. And rather than allow it, she was taken away from psychiatric treatment, which would have calmed her down. They know how to do that.
By the Citizens Commission on Human Rights.
Exactly, by this same organization with the oxymoronic name. So I can understand from my position, you know, as somebody who's been a historian of this subject for 40 years, those reports don't exist. The idea that everything is known by some person, it's come to the point where it's impossible to know everything that happens on a daily basis. So let me move to specific and simple questions. I hate to do this, Mike, because you are my friend, but have you ever criminally assaulted a child?
No.
No.
No. No, I have not, ever. I wouldn't dream of such a thing.
Exactly.
John, I consider that I sort of criminally assaulted my children by having them born into the Sea Org. Honestly, that is, you know, perhaps the biggest regret in my life. But I have never laid a hand on a child. I have never engaged in any sexual activities with a child. I've never engaged in anything even remotely like that, ever.
And let me go on record to say the same is true for me. I have four children. I have never spanked or smacked any of them. I've only raised my voice to them a few times over the years. I believe that there is a sanctity there, that children deserve to be protected. So even shouting at a child to me is a wrong thing to do. And the very few times that I've done that, I have apologized to my children for doing it.
I am exactly the same, John. I have lost my temper on a handful of occasions with my children one way or the other. But I always regret it after the fact and apologize. I have never struck them. I never would. It's unthinkable to me.
Exactly. It's absolutely unconscionable and without thinking, all right, next one. Have you ever covered up or in any way hidden a criminal assault upon a child?
No, not and not that I am in any way aware of. And I only give that caveat because I, like, there are thousands and thousands of things that have happened over the 25 years or so that I was involved or engaged in external affairs in Scientology. And there are, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of documents and reports and people out there. And it is, of course, possible that something happened somewhere and I signed off on something that, you know, was insignificant at the time or seemed insignificant that then resulted in someone doing something that then resulted in something like this sort of snowball effect. But to my knowledge, recollection, and best memory, I have never been engaged in anything that was covering up child abuse or child sexual abuse in the time that I was in the Sea organization. Just, it, you know, there were certainly conditions like in the childcare facilities that were horrible and should never have been allowed, including of my own children, you know, and that, you know, sort of falls into the category of child abuse. I mean, the dirty nurseries with untrained women looking after infants and children, and their neglect and their lack of education and all of that sort of stuff that was all very well justified in the minds, in my mind and the minds of all the Sea Org parents who were involved and knew that that was going on. You know, and I'm not going to get into all the explanation. I cover that extensively in my book, why that seemed to be an acceptable way of raising children. And that stuff was definitely covered up. It was covered up when, you know, inspectors would come and they would be turned away at the door by security and told they had to come back in 3 days. And then there would be frantic efforts to clean everything up and make it all look nice and that sort of stuff. But outside of that, absolutely not.
Okay. And let me add that one of the stories that I helped with back in the early 90s in the UK was to do with inspections, that the social services would give notice that they were going to inspect. And I got, you know, documents were given to me, or copies of documents, we have to be very careful about this, were given to me, which made your front page story in the UK about the Stonelands, where children were being, you know, it was zoned for, I don't remember, something like 50 people, and there were more than 200 in there. And children, there was a report talking about children being hidden in closets so they wouldn't be seen, about them being given proper food for the day that this would happen. You know, they'd get an orange, apparently, not something they saw very often. I also extensively interviewed, I've interviewed a lot of people who were children in the so-called nurseries and in the so-called cadet org. And the stories, it's one of the reasons I kept going for so long, realizing just how terrible this had been. But we all bought into this idea that you know, history was a race between Dianetics and the atomic bomb, and that if we didn't do something, you know, the whole agonized future of every man, woman, and child on this planet depends on what we were doing. There was this incitement, this sense that we'd have to compromise on our own living, which is something that everybody in the Sea Org did, you know, sleep deprivation, the rotten diet, the, you know, the awful bullying that was going on, was all seen as self-sacrifice, all as something that was being given to a nobler cause of saving humanity from World War III, as L. Ron Hubbard put it. So those are the conditions in which it occurred. Okay. Have you ever been charged with a criminal offence against a child?
No.
And it's been alleged that because there is no evidence that L. Ron Hubbard designed the handlings that are put into place for cover-ups, that you must have done it. And that's, you know,
I don't know what to say about that one, John. That's just like, there's a lot of other people that sort of came between me and the L. Ron Hubbard, like Mary Sue Hubbard and Jane Kember and Mo Budlong and all those guys. But honestly, Hubbard, the amount of orders and guardians orders and advices and subsequent OSA network orders written by L. Ron Hubbard about how to conduct the external affairs of Scientology, you don't need anything more. I mean, he fancied himself an intelligence operative, and you know, I've put a lot of stuff on my blog in various articles, quoting the statements from Hubbard about case agents and, you know, how Scientology runs case agents and how you compartmentalize information and you never let one person over here know what the other guy is doing, and the ways of framing people and setting them up. And, you know, you don't need to come up with new stuff. Hubbard, in his inimitable fashion, has extensive writings on the subject of how you do all this shit and how you organize an intelligence agency, which is what he called this. He called this intelligence, and he modeled it on spy agencies, or what his understanding of spy agencies was from reading a couple of books.
The Spy and His Masters and
the
Black
Spy
Boomerang.
And Black Boomerang. Yeah, exactly. Not actually his history, which was what he claimed.
No, it's he was never in intelligence.
In naval intelligence. But be that as it may, it doesn't mean that he didn't write stuff directing Scientology how to do this. Look, the Guardian's office conducted the largest infiltration of the United States government in its history, not based on random Joe Blow coming up with an idea, let's infiltrate the United States government, but based on what Hubbard said needed to be done in order to save mankind. This is what all of those things are written about. There's no need for anything new in Scientology. It's all there. It's all, you can find the answers to how to go about doing anything and everything within Scientology or within life or washing cars or washing windows.
Putting flowers in a vase.
Yes. In the writings of L. Ron Hubbard. I didn't invent any new stuff when I was in Scientology. Nobody actually does.
No, all of the technology belongs to Ron Hubbard, as he said. You know,
right.
I've encountered this. You know, there's a book called Arrows in the Dark, where a former member of the Guardian's office says Hubbard didn't know about this. And I'd just like to point out that the tip of the iceberg is actually above the water. Ron's journal, 1967, a tape-recorded lecture, in which he at one point says, you know, we're the fire engine rushing to the fire. Let's not bother with the yapping of the dogs at the wheels. And right. Then he says, Mary Sue, his wife, has hired former professional intelligence agents, not private detectives. Though in fact,
right.
Rick Filson was just a private detective, the guy was hired, to investigate the backgrounds of Cecil King, the press baron, and the Prime Minister of Britain, Harold Wilson.
Right.
So he had initiated and admitted to an intelligence operation against the British Prime Minister in 1967. If you then look into the investigation Full Hat, which was reissued, I think, in 1990 by Miscavige, and it's an 800-page pack. A friend of mine reconstructed it from the check sheet, which the FBI got. So we put a copy of it online, I think, in 1995, all 800 pages of it. Nearly all of it is written by Hubbard or comes from Hubbard, transcripts of Hubbard lectures. And you have there the instruction of how to lie, training routine L, training routine lying, how to break and enter. That's in there, should you need to know the technology of breaking and entering. And so people want to think that there was some other source. The source of Scientology was Ron Hubbard. The fact that just about everything he did was plagiarized from some other source and he rubber stamped it, having altered it in some way, because he believed you had to alter things to make them persist. You have to enter a lie into things. And he did it naturally. But, you know, that's certainly my conclusion. And trawls have gone on through two sets of documents, those involving Carmen Rayner and also Steve Kinnane. and the incredible archive of material he went through. And I'm, you know, I have a third source, somebody who's actually been through an unbelievable amount of documents. Your name is not coming up. You know, it will come up in some orders. And, you know, our time today is, you know, I don't want to, you know, I understand that you've had a pretty difficult year. And I don't, yes. And I understand that fatigue is one of the side effects of the treatment that you're receiving. So call it a day anytime you need to. But because there is so much more that you know, we're not going to get through. But
right.
If I can ask you some direct questions that have come from Miriam. So she says, Kerry Francis, her mother, the artist, flew from Sydney to Los Angeles in 1984 and 1986 as an OSA operative doing undercover work against psychiatry in Sydney. And her question from that is, when did you first meet Kerry Francis? Of your recollection.
I really don't recall. I don't recall any of this story about her being an undercover operative. Who knows? Maybe she was. Maybe she was working for OSA in Australia. I my interest in Kerry was her artistic skills. It had nothing to do with anything else, just that she could paint pictures. Mm. And I don't remember when I first met her. I mean, maybe it was 1986, maybe it was 1984. I actually don't know.
Okay, that's fair enough. She then says, in 1988, Scientologists connected to the removal of records from Chelmsford Private Hospital were transferred to the US to avoid implication in the investigations by the Royal Commission into deep sleep therapy. And she asks, is this why you transferred my mother to the US in 1988? No. And that's a leading question, isn't it?
Doesn't have anything to do with it. I didn't even know about these people that were transferred people from Australia
to the US.
But I thought that the issue with Chelmsford was the prosecution of Chelmsford.
Yes, it was. And
why would people be whatever. No, yeah. It didn't have anything to do with Chelmsford. It had to do with Kerry being an artist who had portraits hanging in Parliament House in South Australia of the Prime Minister of South Australia or whatever it was. Mm. Like, she was a renowned portrait artist. And, you know, if you look at the pictures, the paintings in the latest version of the What is Scientology book that Scientology no longer uses, because it lists all the addresses of all the churches and missions of Scientology around the world that used to exist. Mm. You will see that clearly she is a very, very skilled, fine portrait artist. Mm. Her likenesses of L. Ron Hubbard are very glamorized. You know, there's no black teeth, but they're very recognizable. This is clearly a portrait of L. Ron Hubbard, unlike the ones that were done by Arthur and Andre Clavel in the original Wisp book, which you couldn't even tell what they were pictures of.
Yeah, they are truly dreadful. And just so that everybody knows, I actually have a copy of the later edition of What is Scientology propping up my screen at the moment. And it's proved very useful for that. I've used it for years. I haven't looked in it for a long time, but...
Well, I have one right behind me.
Oh, there we go.
here we go. What is Scientology?
Yeah. And oh, that's a nice binding on that one.
The L. Ron Hubbard pictures.
Mm. Yeah, which are way superior to the ones in the dreadful first edition, which I also, of course, have a copy of. Maybe I should put that under my computer too, but...
Kerry painted every one of these pictures. She's not given any credit.
No, L. Ron Hubbard is the source of everything in Scientology, Mike.
Right.
Okay. She says, were you involved in dissuading the mother of Tony Strawn's victims not to go, mothers perhaps, of Tony Strawn's victims not to go to the authorities?
No.
Very simple, this, isn't it, when we get down to it?
Yeah.
She asked, And I think we've already answered that, so I'm not going to ask it. And in fact, that's all I have on that particular one. She's this weekend, she sent to me and emailed me and said that you'd made public a the LAPD report that she made.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true?
Yes, I put it on my blog. You can go buy that. That report is not secret.
Yeah.
In fact, the detective, when I was mentioning earlier, I spoke to him. He said, look, would you mind taking that off your blog? Even though you had, you know, I know where you got this from. I think that we gave it to you. But and in any event, anybody can just go buy it from the LAPD. But for a reason that he gave me, that I don't want to go into here, he asked me if I would be willing to either remove it or redact it for certain information contained in there. And I said, of course, if that's something that you feel will be helpful, of course.
And you've now removed it, yeah?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay, that answers that. I think we should wind up. I think I've taken enough of your time and energy for today. I've been accused of, just one last little question. I was asked to take down a video we did called Truth and Certainty, which is on my channel, because the complainant who wished to remain anonymous, which I'm suspicious of. I think if you're going to make allegations, you should go public. It's what I did. You know, look what happened to me. Or maybe the guy's right, actually. But he put forward the idea that you'd made a statement which was a whitewash, which was reprehensible, and which was disgusting. Those are the three words he used repeatedly to me. And the statement you made was, Jerry Armstrong seems to think that I have a treasure trove of documents that I'm not releasing. Now, have you released any documents in the last 3 years since that happened?
Okay. God, this is
the thumb drive story, I think.
Yes.
Yeah.
When I escaped from London in 2007, I downloaded whatever it was that happened to be on my laptop computer at that time onto a thumb drive. I turned that thumb drive, I made a copy of it, but I turned it over, the original thumb drive, to the FBI in the first interview I had with them in 2010.
Okay.
Subsequently, there were some of those documents that I gave to Marty Rathbun and some other people who then published some of them, programs like on Chuck Beatty and Dave Turetsky and others, just because I thought that they were so revealing and important. There's a whole bunch of stuff in that was on that computer that is completely useless. It's just random, like financial planning reports or, you know, cover sheets that have nothing attached to them and all sorts of stuff. And more recently, those documents have been being used by people. And it's like the new OSA documents. They're not new. John Sweeney quotes from those documents extensively in his Church of Fear book. That came out, I don't even remember when it was, 2013 or something?
I think it was somewhere around there. It was out by the time I met him in 2015.
Right. I have filed affidavits in various court cases from the 2012 period on saying, these documents I provided to the FBI, they have now been circulated in various places And in fact, I refiled one of those declarations that I had filed in the Monique Rathbun case to support some of the documents that were used, saying, yes, these are authentic copies of documents that I had that I turned over to the FBI. In any event, there's no new documents or new revelation. There may be new people who got their hands on them, but they're certainly not new.
The documents, in fact, I was sent a huge cache of documents, and it probably is that cache of documents. And the metadata clearly dated them at 2007.
Right. Yeah.
So it confirms what you're saying. Okay. There are people who are going to be very upset with us. There are people who are very upset with us. I made the mistake of throwing in my lot with you so that people can shout at me. I'm quite used to that, unfortunately. I want to make a point about justice. We would like anybody who has any information about the criminal activity of Scientology or any of its members to report that information. We encourage that. We would most certainly support any effort to bring together, charges against the organization with regard to the abuse of children, which has been systematic within Scientology in terms of the psychological abuse and the physical abuse of children. That should be reported. One of the things that Miriam said to me was that she felt unseen and unheard. And I tried to reassure her that I've spent 40 years. You know, the first child case I worked on was the Leahy case in July 1984, when I brought two new witnesses to the mother's team in that case. Since then, I've worked on many child cases. I've done my very best in Let's Sell These People a Piece of Blue Sky. There's material about the ranch in Mexico and scorpions. I didn't want to do this. I'm a painter. I'm a novelist. I'm a musician. But somehow I've spent most of the last 40 years doing this. I am retired, but only have a state pension because I have no savings. That's because this has been important. And I want Miriam to be reassured that there are people who care and there are people who are doing something. But I also want to say that if there is information against you, Mike, by now, enough thousands of people, tens of thousands of people have heard about this. If you have information about Mike, send it to Miriam. And if, you know, the standard is absolutely set in the US, in Australia, and in the British courts, that you are guilty when it is proven beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, I have looked at everything that's been sent to me, and I have not found anything that proves your guilt. I've seen a lot of speculation. He was the head of OSA, so he should have known. He was the head of OSA, so he must have done this. But as you said at the beginning of our conversation, that's an incredibly complicated situation where you've got hundreds and hundreds of organizations with all sorts of daily affairs going on and this desire not to report, so that there will be no record of the criminal activities of the different departments. And it's probably a lot more complicated than people realize. When I first went to East Grinstead in 1975, I stayed in the house for months with a guy called Dave Cusworth, and he kept going away for 2 or 3 days and then coming back. I had no idea until after I'd left Scientology that he worked for Branch One. He was being sent to foreign countries to perform criminal acts, I believe, from what I was told. I don't want Dave to sue me. And then he'd come back looking very sleepy and realizing just how complicated this intelligence network was. Lawrence Wright says there were 5,000 people working in it. I think he's got, I don't know where that came from. It was never quite that bad, but there was certainly, right, you know, more than 100 people in the French, British, Canadian, German governments, Italian, Spanish, wherever you go. I've talked with government, those agents of those governments over the years, and found out about infiltration. It's a very complicated organization. So if there is proof beyond a reasonable doubt, I would say that in the next month, next 2 months, it would be possible for anybody who's a witness, anybody who wants to come forward, to contact Miriam and give her the information they have. And if charges are to be filed, they should be filed. If there are no charges to be filed, then you are innocent until proven guilty. So I'd just like to emphasize that and go back to the beginning of the conversation. There are perhaps 4,000 slaves in Scientology. They should be our focus. And all of the crimes should be our focus. But these people are on a daily basis right now being harmed. That's why the Aftermath Foundation came into being, which was started by Luis Garcia and Aaron Smith Levin.
That's shorthanding. Yes.
Yeah.
Actually, and me.
Okay.
Because the reason it's called the Aftermath Foundation is because it was the effort was to get me and Leah both involved in it. And
okay.
We were the sort of impetus for it. Anyway, I didn't even want to get into that in great detail. Okay, so the Aftermath Foundation started. Yes.
Yes, you were a part of beginning that. And the objective of the Aftermath Foundation is to help people to escape from Scientology and to help them to recover from Scientology. And a lot of people have been helped, and hopefully a lot more will be. I've known you for, 3-4 years now. Nothing you have ever said to me has proved to be untrue.
Thank you, John. I appreciate that. I try to be as absolutely frank and honest and straightforward as I possibly can. I know that memories are not necessarily accurate. I even wrote in my book at the beginning, you know, the sleep deprivation that goes on in the C organization, particularly at the top, is horrendous. Mm-hmm. And it is endemic. Mm-hmm. And by definition, sleep deprivation fuzzes your brain and memory. And so there is always the chance that my memory is not perfect. Mm-hmm. In fact, I would say there's more than a chance that my memory is not perfect.
Just like everybody else.
Right. But I try to be as carefully accurate and truthful as I possibly can. And I appreciate you recognizing that. Before all this latest blow up, we have had some pretty intense discussions about all sorts of different things, and not being under the crosshair target during all those times. It's nice to know that you see things that way. Mm-hmm. And that thank you for saying that.
You've also never once, and this is our 13th conversation, refused to answer a question.
Right.
I've never had any sense. I perhaps understand your situation a little better than many people, because I was harassed.
Right.
On a daily basis for 16 years. And
yep.
I know that you know how that works. And so when you stood up, you took your life in your hands. When you put your head above the parapet, you knew that you were going to have a very hard time. It would have been so easy to just walk away, because in 40 years, I've interviewed a number of people who worked in branch one or investigation. And you're the only one who's gone public in all that time. And taken the risk of prosecution if that was there. I applaud your courage. And as Shakespeare said, the evil that men do lives after them. The good is oft interred within their bones. And Miriam Francis makes the point that we have to consider the bad as well as the good. And she's right. But we also have to consider the good as well as the bad. You reached millions of people through the Aftermath show. It changed the landscape. It meant that the American public and more widely in the world, people understood what Scientology has been and what it's done. And it slowed them down tremendously. I think, in L. Ron Hubbard's terms, that in the cycle of growth, that we have passed conservation and we are in the stage of decay for the Church of Scientology and hopefully death.
Yes.
So that those 4,000 slaves can be released into the world. They need to be released into a world where there are people who know what to do to help them. And at the moment, the only organization in the world that knows that is the Aftermath Foundation. So, you know, more power to you. Let's get together again somewhere along the way and talk about some more things.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm doing considerably better physically, so I always enjoy our chats, as challenging sometimes as they are, but I find that the intelligent, reasoned approach that you take to everything, John, is not only something that I enjoy interacting with you because of that, but I also learn things. You have taught me a lot of stuff, a lot of things, and given me a lot of perspective on things, and I really do appreciate it, and I thoroughly enjoy the time that we are able to spend together chatting about various things. And I think that you are a remarkable example of someone who has taken the mantle upon his shoulders to actually do the work to change things. I got in a lot of trouble for making a comment about keyboard warriors. And, I wrote about that on my blog. You know, when it's not that hard to whatever. I wrote about it on my blog. But there are people that there are two categories of people in this world of former Scientologists or activists or ex-Scientologists or anti-Scientologists, however you want to categorize it. There are those who do the work, and there are those who comment on the people doing the work. And that doesn't necessarily mean that the comments are bad. They can be incredibly supportive and helpful.
And
but
astute,
they're not the people that are doing the work. And by that, I mean actively engaged in doing things that change the circumstances or help the victims or expose the crimes in some fashion. So I look to you as someone who has been doing this for longer than I have and as a sort of a role model. And I just wanted to say that because I haven't said that to you before. I do consider you a role model. I think that you're reasoned, sensible, intelligent, calm approach to exposing and trying to rectify the abuses of Scientology is the most effective and the most I'm not quite sure what word to use, but I identify with that as the right way of doing this. I identify your approach and your methods as the way that I want to do the work that I think needs to be done.
Well, thank you. That's very kind. And let me make just one little note, something that I wrote on my pad as we were going along. And you said that there were people who didn't, the detective, the LAPD detective, has said these people did not realize they were victims. And one of the clever things that Ron Hubbard did was to turn certain words into what are called snarl words. So the word fascist is a snarl word. The word dictator is a the word appeasement, which is in fact a perfectly positive thing, is a snarl word because of, you know, Chamberlain and all of this and the misperception of what he did. But the word victim to a Scientologist is one of those words. And accepting that we were, by dictionary definition, victims of Scientology can be an important step in growing and saying, yes, you know, I didn't ask for this to happen to me. I didn't subscribe to this. It was done to me, you know.
Yes.
And therefore exposing those who committed that abuse, whoever they are, wherever they are. Okay. It's always a pleasure, Mike. Lovely to see you. And I'm so glad that you're recovering. It's wonderful. And please, you know, whoever's watching this, go away and think about this and think about the approach that we're advocating, which is not snark. It's not attacking. It's not calling David Miscavige the asthmatic dwarf or stuff like this. This is, you know, there's serious business here. There are people who need help. And so we should take the view of tolerance and kindness, and expose those who have committed the crimes. And if that was Mike and I have no evidence that would stand up in a court of law, but if you have that evidence, provide it to Miriam and we'll go with it. And let's
I would just add to that, John.
Yeah.
You don't even have to provide it to Miriam. Go to law enforcement. Mm. Go. You know, it's not, Miriam isn't the central collector of all criminal activities of Mike Rinder. That go to law enforcement, go to the FBI, go to wherever, go to your local police department.
Yeah,
go do it. You know, I'm 100% in support of this campaign.
Okay, the campaign to get Mike Rinder.
Exactly. Exactly.
Let's lynch him. Let's just lynch him and not bother with the facts, you know.
Yep.
A great pleasure as ever. Thanks so much, Mike.
You're very welcome, John. Lovely to see you again.
Hi, John here. Thanks for watching. We'd appreciate it very much if you would click like, as well as subscribe, and click the bell for notifications. Every dollar helps, and we welcome new patrons on Patreon. Or you can make a one-off payment with any currency through PayPal. Thanks so much.